this. Hello, this is Terry Ewell, and I'm here with Jim Lasley, who was just honored today by the International Double Reed Society as an honorary member for his lifetime achievement to the double reed world. And Jim is going to talk a little bit about how he got started in music and how he got started in the repair business.
I started playing the bassoon at age 13. My father brought it home and had to tell me what it was. I had been playing the trumpet up to that point. Dad was a musician and had many students, and he could play a lot of instruments. And so that's how I began. I took a few lessons from a graduate student at the old Arthur Jordan Conservatory in Indianapolis. And I was on my way and played all the way through what was left of junior high school and high school, and went to school down in at the Western Kentucky. It was the state teachers' college at that time in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And the war came along, and I just kind of let myself be drafted, and managed to get into a very, very fine band in the Army. And in there was a really seasoned professional bassoonist. His name is Gabe Selig, and Gabe helped me an awful lot. He also taught me to make reeds. And there again, the reeds were terrible, but I played them anyway. And after the war, I came back home in Indianapolis and worked in my dad's shop for a while. Learned many, many basic things from my father, who worked on everything. Brass horns, clarinets, saxophones, and you name it. No stringed instruments, thank God. But I learned the basics from him. And at that time, the Indianapolis Orchestra was really getting on its feet. It had started back in about 1937, was having a hard time. But we were getting young people, new graduates out of Juilliard, Eastman, whatever, bassoon players. And I saw a lot of their work, which was done by a gentleman named Hans Meinig in Philadelphia. And the quality of that work really impressed me. And I told myself that if I'm going to do anything like this, I want to do it this way. He would not do a cosmetic job per se, but the quality and the beauty of his work just spoke for itself. In later years, I got to know Mr. Meinig very, very well. And so I worked for my dad off and on, and then I decided I wanted to go up to Elkhart and work. Of course, that's where all the work was at that time. Elkhart was the band instrument capital of the world. And I went up and I worked for a guy named Jack Linton, who used to make some bassoons. They weren't the greatest bassoons in the world, but I learned an awful lot working there. And I also did oboes for years, and I went to work for a cousin of Jack's named Clarence Linton, and he made an oboe when I think it's still being made under the name of Larry Lee. His son's name was Larry Lee, and that's how he named his oboe. And I worked for him, and he was selling oboes to the Chicago Musical Instrument Company in Chicago, big importers and big distributors all over the place. And they had a man there named Frank Ummon, who had been apprenticed to Heckel when he was 12 years old. And he made bassoons. At that time, he had made around 150 or 180 bassoons. And he came down for Chicago Musical Instrument and worked in Clarence's shop, brought his own lathe, his own drill press, everything. And I had the opportunity to work under him. And we made three prototypes for the Selmer Company. And I learned more in that short time that I worked with Clarence, with Frank, that I've ever learned in my whole life. The man was an absolute genius. And to see how he made a bassoon, it was just a revelation. And I used things all the time that I learned from him. We got to be very good friends. He did his drinking at a little railroad tavern down on the railroad yards Elkhart was a rail center then and may still be for all I know, but this dirty little place, you couldn't see through the windows. He drank whiskey, they had beer in there and whiskey and cigars and chewing tobacco, and that was about it. But when we finished the first bassoon, I had to go down there and play it for these guys because they didn't believe Frank was making anything like he was talking about. And that was an experience. Anyway, I worked down there for a while, and we got that project done, and my dad wanted me to come back to Indianapolis and work for him, which I did for a while. And then oh my gosh, I'm going to have to quit gesticulating here. That's ridiculous. I was tired of Elkhart. I didn't find it a very friendly place at all, but I had learned so much there, but I should have stayed with Frank, and he tried to convince me to stay, but I didn't. Later on, shortly after that, he left Elkhart and went to the F.E. Olds plant out in California, which was owned by Chicago Musical Instrument, and he spent the rest of his days out there. And he made, I think, about 80 bassoons out there while he was there. I would love to get my hands on one, but I have never seen one for sale. But anyway, after that, I decided to try something different. And I always kept a shop at home, a little shop that I could do bassoons and stuff. And decided that I wanted to do something different. I had a chance to go to work for a lumber and millwork company that was owned by a friend of mine, and I became their outside salesman. I called on builders and designers and things like that, and it was a job that I really enjoyed for a while. And the company that I worked for was bought by another company, which was bought by a conglomerate, and these people, they were the people that made the jetways that go out to airplanes, and they were not interested in the lumber business, so they just dismantled it. And I had several jobs I could have gone to, but I just walked out into my shop in about 1972 or 73, and went to work. And I very laboriously created a letter which extolled my expertise and all the great stuff that I could do on musical instruments, especially the oboe and the bassoon, and had them all printed up and in envelopes and everything, and they're still up in the attic of my shop. I've never sent any of them. I was already so busy I couldn't. I didn't need them, but it's been pretty good. I had met a lot of guys when I worked for my father, from New York especially, who remembered me, and their students remembered me. And not only that, I didn't know it at the time, but my idol, Hans Meinig, was sending work people to me all the time. Yeah. And later on, when I got to know him, I thanked him profusely. I went to see him, as a matter of fact. Lenny Sherrill was playing with the Pittsburgh Orchestra, and they were in a town close to Philadelphia that they spent the summers in. So I went to see him, and I went to see Meinig at the same time. And we spent an afternoon together, and it was really great. Then I went to see him again after he had moved out of his place there in Philadelphia and was at home. Paul and I went there, as a matter of fact, and we stopped, and we had planned to take Hans and his wife out to dinner, but she made dinner, and we had dinner with them and everything. So later on, I wrote him a letter and thanked him for everything. In the meantime, I had sent him a lot of things. I had sent him cork, which he was short on, and introduced him to the ultra suede that everybody uses on bassoons now. I found out about that from my wife, who was making her clothes out of it at that time, and we had a lot of scraps around. But he wrote me back, and I guess his assistant, Casimir, I never knew his last name, had passed away. And he said he was in the process of cleaning up after Casimir's part of the shop, and his own too, because he don't want somebody else to have to do that for him. But he said, in the manner of my sending you people to you, he said, I send them because I know they will be well served. And he said, you're the only one I have ever recommended. And I've thought about maybe publishing that in the IDRS Journal, but what for, you know?
Did you see him as being a real inspiration to you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he just, his work was so spare, and it was functional.
Yeah.
And he made no attempt. In other words, you couldn't take a bassoon in there and have him have the keys plated or do a restoration like we do. He just wasn't in that. And, of course, he was deep into clarinets and oboes and all the double reed and single reed instruments. Don't think he worked on saxophones. But everything he did was just absolutely immaculate and functional, practical, you know.
Can you tell me at all any of a sort of a funny story or anything that may have come up at all?
Well, not much in connection with Hans. He did have a good sense of humor. I'm trying to think. Oh, we were eating at his house, and I know that Hans Moiser in Cincinnati, when he ate dinner, everything was on a different plate. Every vegetable was on a different little plate, and the salad and everything, other than, you know, you having a salad plate and the other stuff was on one big plate. Anyway, Hans was like that. It must be a German thing. And he had a salad, and it had some berries in it. He said he got them off a bush that was down on the sidewalk, and he didn't really know what they were, but they looked good. And his wife had made this great salad and put these berries in it, and it was good. It was marvelous. So Paul Nordby, who helps me in the shop, he ate most of his and pushed it back, and Hans ate his, and then he took a spoon and lapped up the liquid dressing that was on there, and he turned and saw that Paul had left his. He says, eat the juice! Eat the juice! And Paul grabs up his spoon and starts lapping it. But he was a wonderful guy, and we've got a lot of strange stories, but most of them don't concern him.
Do you have a favorite piece for bassoon or oboe you'd like to recommend?
Well, for the oboe, I like the Schumann Three Romances, and I wrote those off for the bassoon many years ago and played them, performed them, and I still think they're really great bassoon pieces. But there are others, of course, and I'm really fond of some of the South American stuff that seems to be coming up now. Some of it is very beautiful and very interesting, and I'm not good right now remembering titles, but there is a one guy, his name is De Rivera, yes. And I really enjoy his work a lot.
Yes. I do too. De Rivera's written some wonderful works.
Absolutely.
Is there a final story or something you'd like to just share with us?
Well, we're going to, when we do our so-called lecture, we're going to show film of a really... Of course, our theme is, you know, go home and practice. That means do that instead of fiddling around with your bassoon. Because we've got, the result of that has really resulted in some really awful things. But this guy brought the bassoon in. It was a 7,000 series. And
Heckel bassoon.
And, of course, the 7's always been very desirable. And he had absolutely butchered it. He had cut into the finger, the holes, so his fingers went into the bassoon. It was just, I won't try to describe it, because if you come to our lecture, you're going to see. And so I had to plug so many holes with wood, big pieces, you know, of wood and everything, that I refinished it black, and it turned out pretty good. And when he saw it, he said, oh, my God, that's gorgeous. Can you do my 10,000? I said, you have a 10,000? He said, yes. I said, have you done your particular magic on this bassoon? Well, he said, I did a few things to it. So he brought it in. He's living in Louisville at the time. I don't want to mention his name. But he had been a professional player. And the 10 was three times as bad as the 7. And you'll see pictures of it. But every time I asked him, why did you do this or why did you do that? His answer was the same. I thought it might be leaking. And I can't describe to you the things that he has done. That's one of the reasons we're doing this thing. And you'll find it interesting, I think. But he still didn't have the idea. And when he brought the other, I said, bring the other one back, you know, when you get it kind of played it a little bit and we'll make any adjustments that you need. He brought it back and he had already started doing these things. Oh. It was awful.
Oh my.
And it made me mad. And I closed up the case. I said, take it and get the hell out of here. Don't ever come back.
Right.
I said, I've got other things to do besides give you something to tear up. And I said, oh, by the way, take your $10,000 with you too. And he became almost teary-eyed, and I really felt sorry for the guy, and I was sorry that I'd been so hard on him. So I told him I'll never do work on the black one again, but I will go ahead and do this one, and don't ask me when it'll be done. I actually kept it 3 years, I think. But we got it all done, and it was great. I was working with the ISO then, and I took it to a performance, and Bob Brimmel, who was principal then, played a 10,000 that was just a couple of numbers off this, and he played the concert on it and thought it was great. And it was great. But when he came to pick it up, he complained that he'd had the money in the bank for I don't know how many years, and he could have been drawing interest on it and so forth. And I said, that doesn't concern me at all. I said, if you don't want to pay for it, I've always wanted to own a anyway, he said, oh, I didn't mean that. So I told him, I said, I'm really sorry to talk to you about like this, but I said, if you touch one screw on that bassoon, don't ever bring it back to me. I said, I'll know. No matter what you do, I'll know it. And if you do, just don't come back. I've never seen him since, and that was a good 15, 20 years ago.
Well, thank you, Jim, so much for the interview. Really appreciate your time.
The purpose of that was not to extol my business virtues or anything, but the theme of what we're trying to do here is to tell people, don't waste your time fooling around with your bassoon. You can many times, of course there are people who know what to do, but many people don't have a clue, and let somebody do it that may know what they're doing, hopefully.
Right. Very good.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
I don't know if that's what you wanted or not.